But right now, let's turn our attention to another outstanding talent, Glenn Goza, as he sings Wrestling.
Well, the boss called me up and said, come in to work. I just hung up on that slave-driving jerk. I'm going to wrestling. Going to wrestling. You think I'd rather be sweating on the dock or watching somebody use a hammer lock? I'm going to wrestling. Going to wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. I love to watch the missing link bang his head on a corner post. And the rumper bumper butt butt delivered by the eyes. The Freebirds, Roberts, Hayes, and Gordy, what I like the most. This Kerry delivering the iron call is only the father it stands. Boss called again, said it's time and a half. You'll come in tonight, and I just had to laugh. I'm going to wrestling. Going to wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. Well, my girlfriend called. Friend, she could be a model for Fredericks of Hollywood, but she was happy. Really happy. Said I could come over early and stay real late, but I told her, honey, if we have a date, we're going to wrestling. Going to wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. There's Kevin Von Erich when he's really high and flying. Silver-haired Ric Flair when he's out there strutting. Andre the Giant must be 7'9". I wouldn't miss this for a dozen girls. I wouldn't miss this for this. I said, honey, I hope you ain't hurt. She said, I'm putting on my wrestling shirt. I'm going to wrestle. Going to wrestle. R-A-S-S-L-I-N, that's wrestling. R-A-S-S-L-I.
That was Glenn Goza singing Wrestling at a World Class Championship Wrestling event at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, Texas, sometime back in the 80s. I had stumbled upon this for the first time this past week and just had to share this musical gem with all of you here this week. And just don't let Vince McMahon know that there is, in fact, a song out there called Wrestling, because I think he'll go crazy. It's episode 138, sound off, scscoops.com. I am the Solid Monster. It is TLC Sunday, December 19th, 2010. Big WWE pay-per-view coming up tonight. I'm sure by the time you all listen to this, the event will probably be over. The top matches on the show tonight, WWE Championship on the line, The Miz, defending against Randy Orton in a table match. We have the World Heavyweight Championship on the line in what was supposed to be a TLC match between Edge and Kane, which has now been transformed into a fatal four-way match that will involve not only Edge and Kane, but Alberto Del Rio and Rey Mysterio, which, from what I understand, it's more of a timing issue. They realized when they looked at what the card was that they weren't going to have enough time, potentially, for all the matches, so they kind of just merged those two together. We have a ladder match between Sheamus, King Sheamus, I should say, and John Morrison with a contract suspended high above the ring. The winner will earn themselves the distinction of being the number one contender for the WWE Championship. We don't know when, presumably at the Royal Rumble. And there's actually a Divas tag team table match as well on the card. John Cena, the newly reinstated John Cena, against Wade Barrett of Nexus in a chairs match. So all that and a lot more coming up tonight on pay-per-view TLC. The only thing I really have to say about this, and this pay-per-view in particular, which could turn out to be a very good show, don't get me wrong, you look at every single match having to be a gimmick match on this show, and it just illustrates exactly what's wrong with that whole philosophy of having these gimmick pay-per-views, where they just, you have to make a match a chairs match just because, or a tables match just because. And any allure of seeing a tables match on a pay-per-view, and I don't think tables matches, quite frankly, have any allure left at all. People don't give a shit. But when you have one on show, you can kind of build it up and make it special. Maybe people will pop for the finish. When you've got two, three, four different tables matches, it just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. My guess would be that John Morrison is going to go over Sheamus to set up at least one title match, perhaps at the Rumble, between he and his former tag team partner, The Miz, who I fully expect to retain the championship, and if he does not, I may just stop watching WWE altogether. But really. So that would be kind of cool if they could set up a Ms. Morrison program. I don't know that it would stretch for much more than a month or so, but that would be my pick in that match. Sheamus does not need to win, and quite frankly, a Sheamus-Miz title match, heel versus heel, does not make a whole lot of sense, nor would it make sense for Sheamus to become number one contender and face Randy Orton if he were to regain the championship, since we already saw Orton and Sheamus with three consecutive pay-per-view matches just a couple of months ago, and quite frankly, they were not all that great. So that's your TLC pay-per-view coming up tonight. Now, if you want to talk really good events that are worth the money, you want to check out Ring of Honor's Final Battle, 2010 show, which emanated from the Grand Ballroom in the Manhattan Center, New York City, just last night. It was an internet-only pay-per-view. I think it was about $15. I had intended on possibly purchasing the show. I may purchase the replay. I was not home, so I did not see the show, but I have yet to see a negative review. The only negatives I've heard about the show are that, again, which can be typical with ROH shows, some of the matches went a little bit long. Some of the matches had way too many false finishes. People kicking out of everyone's maneuvers and moves that, in reality, people should not be kicking out of. But it does not look like anybody really hated this show or thought it was a bad show. It sounds like a pretty kick-ass show, in fact. You can check out the results, the quick results that I posted up on the main page at SE Scoops. Just run through these real quick here. Had the All Night Express in the opener, defeating Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole. Colt Cabana defeating TJ Perkins in a pretty good technical wrestling match. We had women's tag team action. Sarah Del Rey teaming up with Serena Deeb, the former Serena of the Straight Edge Society, defeating Daisy Hayes and Amazing Kong, the former Awesome Kong of TNA fame. We had Eddie Edwards defeating Sanjay Dutt, who was brought in as a replacement for the injured Kenny Omega. Homicide defeating the Ring of Honor TV champion Christopher Daniels, so two former TNA talents. It was a non-title match, and sounds like this is the beginnings of a feud between the two of them. We had the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, and their Papa Mike defeating the Kings of Wrestling and Shane Hagedorn. Apparently, the Briscoes, and it is the Briscoes' real father, by the way. Papa Briscoe busted out something like a Hurricanrana during the match and executed a doomsday device on Shane Hagedorn to get the victory. Sounds pretty cool. Roderick Strong defeating Davey Richards, retaining his Ring of Honor World Championship after Davey passed out in the Stronghold, and the match was stopped. And in the unofficial main event, the non-sanctioned main event, we had El Generico defeating Kevin Steen by pinfall with a wicked chair shot to the head. Not all that enthusiastic about that, but it kind of made sense in the respect that their feud began about a year ago with a chair shot to the head. And so it was poetic justice that Generico would kind of seal Kevin Steen's fate in Ring of Honor by delivering a similar chair shot to the head. And by the rules of the match, Kevin Steen is now officially gone from Ring of Honor. He is retired from Ring of Honor. So there you go. Steen and Generico used to be tag team partners. They were the they kind of played the role of the reluctant partners, the two least let's phrase it like this. The two men on the roster who you would least expect to team up as partners and be successful, and they were for quite a while until Steen turned on Generico. Hence this this additional year building up this big match. And you know, again, that's one of the things missing, I think, from wrestling in general these days. It's not like I expect WWE to have an entire year to build up every single main event feud, but long-term planning, long-term booking, taking your time with your main angles, it really does pay off in the end. You know, this show last night, which, again, I have not yet seen, but just the build-up to this show, the video packages that were put together, it just made the show feel special. And when they call Final Battle the WrestleMania of Ring of Honor, as I think they do, it really does live up to that hype and that you feel as though you're seeing the big show of the year. And by all accounts, the wrestlers went out there, balls to the wall, had a great show, if not a little long, which, again, is one of the criticisms of ROH from time to time. But and I've been to my share of ROH shows in that building, and I've been to shows where, great as they may be, you can't help but look down at your watch and just beg for it to be over so you can get the hell out of there. So anyway, If you didn't see it, the replay is available. I think it's only $15. What I would suggest you do is click the button on the ordering page that lets you test out your bandwidth first, just to make sure that it will play properly. It will not be choppy with, you know, constant buffering and stuff like that. Otherwise, it's worth the money. And so go ahead and check out Ring of Honor Final Battle. You know, I was just thinking, let's just hope that Kevin Steen doesn't come out at the next Ring of Honor TV taping. Cut a passionate retirement speech only for only for him to appear on every fucking show, fucking with El Generico until Generico relents and agrees to reinstate him. Let's hope that does not happen. Speaking of things I wish did not happen, I suppose we need to talk about the three-hour edition of the Slammy Awards on Raw this past Monday night. Not a fan of this show at all. This is one of those shows where I sit in front of my television begging for it to be over. Again, why you have 3 hours and feel compelled to have two-minute matches, I don't quite get that. This show was not good at all. It had its moments. It had its moments, but from top to bottom, it was a shitty Raw. So let's run through the Slammy Award winners first, and then we'll get into some other notes from the show. Shocker of the year was the debut of Nexus on Raw. And that's, you know, hard to argue with. When we look back at 2010, for all the good and the bad, that will be near the top as one of the bigger, more memorable moments of 2010. I still remember that night. People really did feel like the tide was turning. They thought this Nexus thing was going to blow up and become the second coming of the NWO, and this was going to change the face of WWE, and of course we all know what ended up happening, which anybody could have predicted. But it was certainly a shocker, no doubt about that. The Despicable Me Award, CM Punk singing Happy Birthday in a creepy manner to Rey Mysterio's daughter on SmackDown. We had the guest star shining moment of the year, which was just a fucking colossal catastrophe, in my opinion, because William Shatner was robbed on this award. William Shatner singing WWE entrance themes is one of my all-time favorite guest host moments, and for Pee Wee Herman, of all people, to trump him in this category is bullshit, I call. We have the holy shit move of the year, Cena killing Batista by throwing him off a stage, I believe, at Judgment Day, which was Batina. Yes, we have WWE superstar Batina. My God. Batista. That was his last pay-per-view match in WWE before he quit in that memorable last Raw appearance. We had the WWE Universe Fan Reaction of the Year, which was easily won by Angry Miz Girl in a landslide. By the way, she also got the biggest pop of the night when they showed her face on screen. And, of course, Kaylee, I guess, is her real name. They actually found her and her father, brought them out there, and I just... You know, when she got on the microphone and said, I want to thank my dad for taking me to Raw, whatever reason, that just cracked me up. We had the Oh Snap Meltdown of the Year, which was Edge beating up a laptop. Whatever. We had Knucklehead Moment of the Year, which was the person who sent in the last question to the most recent SE Scoops mail bet. No. I'm sorry. It was Lay Cool being beaten by Mae Young. If you have not checked out the latest SE Scoops mailbag on the main page, do go back and check it out. There was an amusing final question a real question sent in by one of the SE Scoops readers. So check that out if you haven't read that already. We had the moment of the year, which was, of course, Shawn Michaels being retired by The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Shawn Michaels taped a speech on site during the Tribute to the Troops show, even though they claimed that this was live via satellite. And one of the interesting things about this was Shawn Michaels saying during his speech that he, in fact, does not miss wrestling. He misses the fans, but he does not miss it. And after this show, who can blame him? And I quote, line of the year, Michael Cole wins that. I did like the video package they put together. It wasn't so much showing different candidates for the award. It was more kind of a best-in-review compilation of some of the funnier moments and lines from 2010, which I thought was funny. And Superstar of the Year was won by John Cena. Again, this was highway robbery. I understand this was the one award they left in the hands of the fans. So, of course, you knew it was going to be Cena or Orton. But for all the people who were emailing me saying that Kane got robbed, listen, people, I'm a Kane fan, okay? I was happy to see him win the World Heavyweight Championship in July. And I've been very happy that he's been given a real title run, okay? Now, this is no 24-hour fluke. He has been champion now for something like 5 months, okay? But here's the thing about Kane. Aside from him actually winning the championship, which was probably long overdue and well-deserved, it's been crappy match after crappy match after crappy match. I mean, of the matches he had on pay-per-view, three of them, with The Undertaker, not one of them was any good. And now this feud with Edge is so fucking horrendous, in large part due to the writing and the bullshit angles that they're doing on SmackDown. Kane, as world champion, as much as I loved him winning the belt, has just been a complete and utter flop. And to give him Superstar of the Year would be just as bad as giving John Cena Superstar of the Year. When you think about Superstar of the Year, if you want to think it, I mean, really, as a real award, how can you go with anybody but The Miz? I mean, here's a guy, again, who was a laughingstock years ago. It's taken him years to rehabilitate his image, for people to take him seriously. He changed his complete look. You know, the clothes that he wore, the tights that he wore, the way he's improved in the ring as a wrestler. But just looking at his year, 2010, he has, and he said this on Raw, he's been, obviously in the past he's been a tag team champion, but he's been the United States champion. Money in the Bank winner. Cashed it in, became WWE champion. If anybody has had a banner year and deserves to be Superstar of the Year, it's somebody like The Miz. But again, they left this award open for fan voting, and we all see the end result. I did find it funny John Cena was talking about being a man of his word and, you know, how he lost, or rather, Randy Orton won at Survivor Series, and so he was a man of his word, and he left. Really, he left. This is what he said. I must have missed that show that he didn't appear on, because it seemed to me like he was on every fucking show after that pay-per-view. But hey, what do I know? Let's see here. Some other notes from Raw before we move on. I did find it comical that David Arquette, the former WCW champion, who, by the way, you know, David Arquette fucking sucked 10 years ago in WCW, and he still sucks. I mean, he was worse than an NXT rookie, for crying out loud. But I find it funny that Arquette came out at the beginning of the show and sounded like he had been on a drinking binge. And in his initial comments on Raw, when Raw went on the air Monday night, he mentioned the name Eric Bischoff, and he dropped the mention of the movie Ready to Rumble. And I made this comment on Twitter because, again, this was like a day after I posted episode 137 last week. And you may remember in the mailbag segment at the end of the podcast, it might have been two different questions, I don't remember, but I talked about Eric Bischoff, and I happened to mention Ready to Rumble. So that was a little eerie. I did make the comment that it sounded like someone had listened to that particular mailbag segment. We had CM Punk, who accepted, of course, his award for Despicable Me, made a comment about somebody having wronged him in the past, and that this person was backstage, and he didn't say who it was. He didn't drop any other hints and just left the impression that at some point in the future, he, in fact, would get his revenge on this person. Now, the first thought that popped into my head initially was John Cena, because John Cena, you know, a couple weeks back was kind of mocking CM Punk, knocked over his diet soda and threw one of his armbands at Punk, who kind of tossed it aside. And perhaps it will be. You know, before Punk got hurt, he was supposed to have a program for the United States title with Daniel Bryan, but Daniel Bryan never did anything to wrong CM Punk. So apparently, this is shaping up to be a slot for a Randy Orton CM Punk feud, or at least that's from what I read. That was the plan as of this past week. Of course, by Punk not being specific and talking about who exactly it was that he was referring to, WWE can change it to pretty much anybody they want. But it sounds like they're going to go with Randy Orton, and I guess what Punk would be referring to in that case, which this would be amazing to me, if they go with Randy Orton here, this would be amazing, because this would require WWE to actually refer back to something that happened in their past. This would cause them to have to be consistent in their storylines, which, of course, is one of the things they're not very good at these days. But you may remember a couple years ago, 2008, it was the Unforgiven pay-per-view, might have been the first time they ever had that scramble match. And CM Punk went into that pay-per-view as the World Heavyweight Champion, and he was attacked backstage by Randy Orton, who then took his spot in the scramble. CM Punk was treated as such a jobber, even though he was the champion. He was beaten up backstage and could not even make it out for the main event. So essentially, he never really lost the championship. But it was Randy Orton who basically cost him the belt, and perhaps they will refer back to that. Otherwise, I don't know who Punk, you know, why else would Punk refer to Orton if Orton didn't wrong him? So we'll find out in due time. Punk, I know, is wrestling some house show matches next week. Apparently, that's just because they're going to be in Chicago, which, of course, is his hometown. And Punk is still not scheduled for a full-time TV comeback for about another month or so. So that's the deal with CM Punk. We did have an Edge and Christian reunion on Raw. Christian came out with his arm in a sling, still recovering from a torn pec. I don't think he's expected back for another 2 months or so, but it was nice to see Edge and Christian on camera. We had John Morrison and Sheamus, who had what I call an abortion. I wouldn't even call it a match. But there was one cool spot. It was ridiculously stupid, I think, for Morrison to do, but Sheamus had set a ladder up on the outside, laying up against the ring apron. And back inside the ring, Sheamus grabbed Morrison, pressed him up overhead, and basically just recklessly tossed him outside the ring, and Morrison landed back first on the ladder. And that looked like it sucked. So that was a cool spot. People probably won't remember it a week from now because it happened on Raw, but they're going to have a match on pay-per-view to determine the number one contender, like I talked about earlier. I'm all for Miz and Morrison for the championship. It's something different. It's something fresh. They have their history together as tag team partners to draw back on. And, I mean, I can just visualize in my head where they're going with this. I mean, if this is the direction they're going to go in, I just see the promo packages now where Miz and Morrison have a face-to-face in the middle of the ring. And, you know, Miz tells Morrison, listen, everybody had me as the Jannetty in this team. And obviously things didn't turn out that way. Now, did they? Now, the thing about this that I'm a little worried about, John Morrison, and I know there's a lot of John Morrison fans here because I've been emailed by a few of them. One person in particular who did not like a comment I made during the mailbag last week when I ridiculed John Morrison's promo skills. The fact is, John Morrison is not a very good promo. And you can say, well, there's people who are worse. Well, you know, that's like slapping somebody in the face and getting blamed and saying, yeah, well, he did it too. He still sucks. And, you know, maybe if he didn't have to operate in the very scripted environment that WWE has, maybe Morrison, if he was allowed to be himself, would be pretty good. But the fact is, he's not. And I fear that if you put Miz and Morrison in the ring together in a back-and-forth verbal battle, that Miz will make him look so inferior that people can't get behind the poor guy. So we'll see where they go with that. I just can't see them having Sheamus as the number one contender with Miz as the heel champion. I just can't see it. The general manager, he or she is anonymous. I get that. They took the general manager dinging to a whole new level on Monday night, to the point that I wanted to take my television and throw it out the window. Enough with the fucking dinging noise. If I hear this dinging noise one more time, I don't know what I'm going to do. But it's not going to be good. Just end this angle, please. I mean, this has gone so far past the point of no return. Like, people just do not give a shit. And the thing is, it's one thing if the GM dings in at the beginning of the show and you never hear from him again. We had the general manager dinging in every 5 minutes on this 3-hour show, and I wanted to just flip my lid. So please, if anybody is listening, if a general manager himself is listening to the show, please stop. Now, John Cena is back in WWE. Just like that, Wade Barrett decided, okay, after... mind you, this is the same Wade Barrett who just a couple of weeks ago said that he would never, ever, under any circumstances, reinstate John Cena, and it took him about a week to change his mind. So, John Cena is back. I didn't know that he was ever gone, but apparently he's back. And you know what? It's not even that really irritated me. What really irritated me was the conditions that Wade Barrett set. And one condition in particular, that he and Cena have a chairs match on the pay-per-view. This just came off to me as so forced, so fake, so phony. What is the rationale? How did Wade Barrett come to this decision that he and Cena have to have a chairs match? Where did that come from? Oh, that's right. It's the TLC pay-per-view. And people have to script this announcement. We have to have a chairs match. It just came off as so fake. Why couldn't Wade Barrett just say, okay, I'll give you a match at the pay-per-view and let the general manager decide what the stipulation is? Spin the wheel, make the deal. I don't care. Just the way that whole thing was announced, it came off as so incredibly fake that it made me angry. And we all know this is obviously, all of this shit's incredibly fake. I mean, John Cena coming out of the crowd when he's no longer with the company and nobody's stopping him is incredibly fake and phony. This angle started so promisingly, and just to see the cliff that this fucking thing has fallen off of, it's really a shame. It just really is a shame. It's also a shame we never got to see Juan Cena on TV, and unfortunately, John Cena himself made the announcement on his Twitter on Monday night, after Raw, in fact, that his cousin, his Mexican cousin Juan Cena, has been given his release from World Wrestling Entertainment. He was wished well in his future endeavors. Poor bastard never even made it to TV. That's a shame. They gave out some other, I guess, supplemental Slammy Awards on WWE.com after the show. I'll just run through these real quick. Best performance by a winged specimen, the Monday Night Raw Chicken. I have no recollection of this whatsoever. I have no fucking idea what they're talking about. But apparently there was a chicken on Raw at one point this year. We had the best use of exercise equipment, Rosa Mendez's use of a shake weight. Again, I have no recollection of this at all. Most menacing haircut, Tyler Rex. Best family values was Kane destroying Jack Swagger Sr., the former Bunkhouse Buck, as Jack Swagger Jr. looked on. Superstar or diva, most in need of makeup was Sheamus, haha. We had the Coal in Your Stocking Award. Daniel Bryan wins for attacking Michael Cole on NXT. We had the Outstanding Achievement in Baby Oil Appreciation to Dashing Cody Rhodes. Frequent Tweeter Award, Goldust. I absolutely agree with this. Anybody who ever subscribed to Goldust on Twitter, he's probably the only person I've ever subscribed to and then had to unsubscribe from. This fucking guy. He just doesn't stop tweeting. And now that he's out hurt for a couple of months, oh my God. I mean... This guy just doesn't stop. So that's an award well deserved. Best WWE.com exclusive TV show, NXT. I thought that was the only exclusive WWE.com TV show. And the most annoying catchphrase goes to Zack Ryder for his woo woo woo, you know it. Well, I could think of about 5 or 10 more annoying catchphrases, but that won the award. So those are the Slammy Awards. It sucked. It's not like it used to be, you know, when they actually had... They would have actual Slammy ceremonies. And they weren't 3 hours long either. This show sucked. A couple of other things here. I was talking about the Carolina Cocaine Crew on the last podcast, Shane Helms. And, of course, I talked about Jeff Hardy. And Bill Behrens, who is responsible for, I think, booking certain TNA talents on the independents. He has some sort of relationship with TNA, although he may not after making these comments. He made a comment on a wrestling radio show that apparently it's an open secret that Jeff Hardy still does drugs and has, in fact, wrestled under the influence. And that Mr. Anderson, who, of course, was on the receiving end of an errant chair shot to the back of the head from Jeff Hardy a while ago and suffered a really bad concussion, which is not to suggest that Jeff Hardy was under the influence at that time, but being that it's an open secret that he has been under the influence while performing, somebody like Mr. Anderson, who suffered a very serious, very real injury on the job at the hands of this man, has a very good case to sue TNA if he wanted to. Of course, he won't if he knows what's in his best interest because he has scorched a bridge with Vince McMahon and WWE. And I couldn't even tell you one thing in particular that he did to do that. It's just Vince McMahon just does not like him. And at least for now, he is still not welcome back in WWE. And TNA has positioned Mr. Anderson as a main eventer. So, you know, there's no reason to expect that he would want to sue TNA. But I just find all of this amusing on the one hand and sad on the other. I mean, again, this is one man's word. But why else would Bill Behrens come out and say this? What's in it for him to come out and lie about Jeff Hardy? And what makes me sad about this is Jeff and his girlfriend, wife, I don't know if they're officially married or not, but Beth, we'll call her, just had their first child within the last 2 months or so. So if Jeff Hardy is still doing this shit, and now he has a kid, and he still has these charges hanging over his head that could send him up the river, it's just incredibly dumb on his part. I mean, I feel bad. I feel bad for the kid. I feel bad for his girlfriend. I feel bad for everybody but Jeff Hardy. I don't feel bad for Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy knows what he's doing. He's a grown adult. He's made a lot of money. And, he's a big boy. He can do what he wants to. But it's just unfortunate to think that if this is true, that TNA is aware of this, and they let him go out there on occasion and perform like that. I mean, if I were on the TNA roster, I would be mighty upset over something like that. So, there you go. Speaking of drug addicts, we had Perry Saturn resurfacing this past week. Of course, Perry Saturn, the mystery of Perry Saturn for the last couple of years. Nobody could find him. Nobody could get in touch with him. His close friends thought he was dead. Nobody could reach him by phone or fax or email or telegram or hologram or smoke signal or walkie-talkie or Morse code or anything like that. He kind of just dropped off the face of the earth, and people were fearing the worst. You know, two of his best friends in Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit met their untimely demise, and perhaps Saturn went off the deep end. Well, he resurfaced actually a couple of weeks ago. He was actually backstage at a WWE show. And he conducted his first interview of any kind, and it wasn't like a formal interview. He was at a wrestling convention of some kind, and Bill After had a microphone and interviewed him for about 6 or 7 minutes for a segment on Bill's site, onewrestling.com. You can find the video on there or on YouTube. I would suggest that you check it out. It's Perry being very open and very honest about where he's been, what he's been up to. He talked about getting shot in the face, I think twice. He didn't explain why or the circumstances behind that. I mean, regular people normally, do not get shot in the face. So I don't know what he may have gotten himself mixed up in, but he got shot in the face, and after that he got hooked on drugs, he got hooked on meth. He was homeless, digging in dumpsters, just a wreck. Just a complete wreck. And one day just decided that he knew he had to get himself cleaned up. Nobody was going to help him but himself. He didn't go through some sort of rehab program. He claims that he quit cold turkey and got sober on his own. And I, you know, for his sake, I hope that's true. But he was looking pretty good, sounding pretty good. And it's good to see Perry Saturn back and not, found dead in an alley somewhere. This is one of those stories that, at least for the time being, seems to have a happy ending. He claims he's clean. He's off drugs. He may want to resume wrestling a little bit here and there in the near future. So good luck to Perry Saturn. I hope he's got his life back on track. The other big story, I guess it wasn't a big story, but it kind of blew up on the internet. And I hope that Big Dave is not listening to this right now, because if he is, let me just say that I apologize. I do not want to do anything to offend you, to make you angry. Please don't kill me. But Dave Bautista's 18-year-old daughter, her name is Athena, is seen in this sex tape on the internet now with her boyfriend, this guy named Justin Miller, or as I like to call him, DOA, being filmed in probably one of the worst sex videos, in all honesty, that I've ever seen. There really isn't much to it. You could easily check it out if you just go online and do a Google search for it. Apparently, the couple plans to drop more tapes of them through other outlets. So, methinks that Mr. Miller is about to disappear. So, anyway, apparently the video was a big hit amongst many of the wrestlers backstage at the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday. It's kind of funny and creepy all at once, but there you go. And lastly here, Taz was on the Busted Open radio show this past week, and he made an interesting comment during his appearance on the Busted Open show, talking about the word belt against the word championship. Again, Vince McMahon, for those of you who don't already know, has banned his announcers on commentary, at least for now, from using the word belt. They must say championship or title. And in fact, Michael Cole actually slipped up a little bit. It might have been on that old school Raw a couple of weeks ago, and he said belt by accident, and then he quickly corrected himself in like a funny manner. This is what Taz had to say, and I quote, "I still won't say title belt. I agree with Vince McMahon on that. It's more prestigious if it is a championship or a title. A belt is something, in Vince McMahon's own words, that you use to hold your pants up. A belt holds up your pants. A championship is something prestigious that is to be held." So that's what Taz had to say on the Busted Open radio show. He agrees with Vince McMahon. What do you think? What do you guys think? Send me an email, thesolemonster@gmail.com, and let me know if you agree with Taz and Vince McMahon, or if you think it's all cock and bull and that people should be able to say whatever they want to on commentary. Let me know what you think. Quick shout-out here before we get into the mailbag to one of our, I think, long-time listeners, actually, Mr. Sorensen, David Sorensen. I made a similar announcement for somebody else a couple of weeks ago about a hacked email account, and apparently David's email was hacked, perhaps without him even knowing it, because I'm still getting spam links via email. I'm pretty much just dumping them all in a spam folder, but you need to take care of that problem or send me emails from a different email address, because the problem is people who aren't aware of this or don't do anything to fix it, what happens after a while is I will simply ban their email address because I don't want any messages from them at all. And if somebody is a regular listener who sends in feedback on a regular basis or a semi-regular basis, pretty good chance I'm not going to get that email from you when you do decide to send me legitimate feedback. So just wanted to let Mr. Sorensen know about that. You might want to take care of that or just start sending me emails from a different email address. So there you go. All right, we got a big mailbag here this week, so I'm going to break into it a little bit early here. We'll start, we'll do some random messages here. We won't go in any particular order. Go with Kyle, your Solomonster. This is Kyle from San Antonio, Texas. Fan of the Sound Off since episode 125. Two questions. Question number one stems from episode 137 last week when I brought up the topic of transitional champions. Question is that, was it planned by WWE to use John Bradshaw Layfield as a transitional champion to help John Cena get over as world champion? It seemed as though throughout that year, Cena was far above the United States title as a worker and on the mic to be on the mid-card. And if this was the case, has there ever been a long-reigning transitional champion like JBL to help advance another superstar's career? As I responded directly to Kyle, by definition, I don't think there's such a thing as a long-reigning transitional champion. You know, you assume here that JBL was a transitional champion. I can't even speak. I would say that you're wrong. I don't look at JBL as a transitional champion. In fact, when JBL became champion, which would have been June of 2004, when he won that bull rope match against Eddie Guerrero at the Great American Bash, I don't believe he lost the championship until he dropped it to Cena at WrestleMania almost a year later. 8 or 9 months as world champion does not make you a transitional champion. And nor do I think the company was planning from June of 04 to have Cena take the title from JBL at WrestleMania. Believe me, they were not thinking that far in advance. So JBL, by definition, was not a transitional champion. He actually got over really well, JBL did, as a heel on SmackDown. And like I said, I don't think they knew that far in advance that they were going to put the belt on Cena so quickly. Second question involves the treatment of Edge's first world title run that brought life to the Rated R superstar. The short feud they had going into WrestleMania had some, I believe he's referring to Edge and Cena. This would have been at the beginning of 2006. This feud had some of the best matches and promos I've seen out of these two. My question is, why didn't WWE let this feud go into WrestleMania 22? And did Edge getting buried by Cena cause the mixed reaction that Cena received in the main event that year in Chicago against Triple H? Cena was already getting mixed reactions from the crowd long before that WrestleMania main event against Triple H. You know, while I know WWE already had plans for Mania that year and they didn't want to deviate from those plans, I still think that it was a mistake not to go with Cena and Edge. I mean, if I were booking, I would have called an audible and kept the title on Edge through WrestleMania. I mean, ratings actually spiked on Raw after he won the title. It was something that felt fresh. It reinvigorated the character. You know, having him drop the title to Cena 3 weeks after beating him for it, Having to drop it back to him at the Royal Rumble 3 weeks later in a crappy submission hold was ridiculously lame. So believe me, if I were booking at that time, if I were Vince McMahon, I would have said, fuck it, we're going to change things up. We have something here that's working, that people are actually into, and we can save Cena and Triple H for some other time. All right, we got a message here from Mr. Vintage, Matt. The Solemn Monster just wanted to mention that Kofi Kingston's pop in New York City at Madison Square Garden while brawling last year with Randy Orton was one of the biggest pops I've ever heard. He was over like McDonald's that night. I have no idea what that means. I really wish they would have followed through better with that. Hope you're feeling better. Well, thank you for that. How could I forget the Kofi Kingston angle at MSG? I was there. I had completely forgotten about that because they never did follow through the correct way on that. I mean, that could have been a real launching pad for Kofi. And instead, it's just so predictable with these guys. The same thing when Swagger won the belt. It's just so predictable that these guys are not going to get over because they don't have any intention of really pushing them as main eventers. And the thing is, you know, I was there in the building that night at the Garden, so my perspective on how big the pop was is going to be different than yours because you, for example, or maybe you were there too, but other people were watching it on TV. It comes off a little bit differently. It could be louder. It could be quieter. You know, now that I really think about it, the longest sustained pop that I may have ever heard in wrestling, or at least in WWE, was Steve Austin's return at Backlash in 2000, when he took out six people with a steel chair and helped The Rock win the WWF title. I mean, that place was going batshit crazy from the moment the glass shattered right up until and after The Rock pinned Hunter that night. So you can find that video on YouTube very easily. From the moment the glass shatters and Austin comes out and just wrecks everybody with a chair and leaves straight through to the finish when The Rock delivered the people's elbow, got the pin. I mean, the people were just going absolutely bananas, to steal a phrase from the late Gorilla Monsoon. And that probably is the longest sustained pop. I know Hulk Hogan has had some 5 or 10 minute pops where he just kind of stands around and people go crazy. But this one had so much fire and so much, it was just electric. It just gives you goosebumps to look back on that. And for those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, do yourself a favor, find the video, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Gianluca in Italy writes in, Dear Solemn Monster, big fan of the podcast, mostly just recently, but I've been hearing your words since episode 30. I'm sending this in because I'm actually very confused. Why the hell are Alex Riley and Miz, I guess more specifically it would be Riley, still carrying around the Money in the Bank briefcase? It's been 3 Raws since he cashed it in, and I surely don't get why it's happening. Perhaps you can shed some light on this. I think Michael Cole actually made a comment on Raw this past week, or maybe the week before. It was a very quick comment. He didn't really expand upon it, but something to the effect of, well, you know, Riley still has the Money in the Bank briefcase to show that Miz cashed in and won the title. And I remember hearing that and just kind of scratching my head and going, well, that doesn't make any fucking sense. My guess would be, I mean, Riley is carrying the briefcase around for a reason. What that reason is, I have no idea. There's no second contract in there, so it's not like he's going to be able to cash in. The Miz has no reason to cash in. I honestly don't know. I don't know. Nobody seems to know. Perhaps 1 week they'll come out and there won't be any briefcase, and there'll be absolutely no explanation for why that angle was dropped. But if he's carrying it around from week to week, there probably is a pretty good reason for it storyline-wise, and I guess we're just going to have to wait for the payoff, because I sure as hell have no idea. It does not make any sense. This comes from James. During your movie review last week, you said that you didn't understand 3/4 of what you were watching. Are you sure you weren't watching an episode of Impact instead? I would rather watch Southland Tales on a loop than watch Impact on most weeks. Besides, The Rock is in the movie, and I know there ain't no way in hell that he'd ever agree to set foot inside the Impact Zone, so I actually wasn't very confused at all. I knew exactly what I was talking about. This comes from Mike D. I was watching some of the Royal Rumble matches recently and noticed something interesting. People love when you get to see tag teams and old friends unite in the Rumble and help each other out. This got me thinking about why WWE doesn't try and form some continuity within the company, keeping old friends obviously friends and enemies staying enemies until storylines dictate otherwise. Pretty simple question that might require a complicated answer. Do you think a wrestling organization could be a success if it had continuity, or is this something too hard to maintain? I would argue that it's harder for a wrestling company to be successful without maintaining some degree of continuity with their storylines. I mean, if the storylines don't make sense, or the company is blatantly disregarding past relationships and angles, for example, best example I could give off the top of my head, pretending that Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had never faced one another before. This actually happened. 2007 Royal Rumble. Go back and remember the Undertaker Shawn Michaels ending, where they were the last two men in the ring, and I think it was JBL, who I'm almost positive was being fed lines in his headset by Vince McMahon, saying, or maybe it was Jerry Lawler. I'm sorry, it was either JBL or Jerry Lawler, but basically the comment was made that here's a confrontation that we've never seen before, completely ignoring the awesome feud that these two guys had. These two guys were involved in the very first Hell in a Cell match, for which they show replays of this and clips from this match constantly. I mean, these guys had a casket match on pay-per-view that Lawler himself called that resulted in the back injury that put Shawn Michaels out of wrestling for 4.5 years. I could not believe when I first heard that little shred of commentary during that Rumble match in 07. It was like, are you kidding me? How stupid, how fucking stupid do you think we are? And it's just stuff like that, that blatant disregard of the past. People like the past, just like people love rankings and they love being involved and getting together with their friends or waiting in line at the building for the show and turning around to the person behind them and, oh, hey, yeah, you remember what happened years ago when these two guys had a match at this pay-per-view and blah, 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 blah. People like doing shit like that. They don't want to pretend that WWE only existed in the year 2010, because if WWE only existed in the year 2010, I would not be a fan of WWE at all. The only reason I'm still a fan of wrestling is because I am sustained by the past and the hope that it will only get better. So, anyway, if you insult your audience, people are a hell of a lot less likely to give a shit, and that's my thoughts on that. This comes from Vic from Vegas. Boy, this guy sounds like a shark. Vic from Vegas. Why doesn't Gail Kim get a push? Of all the divas, Gail can actually perform in the ring very well. It seems nepotism seems to rule amongst the divas. Michelle McCool or Natalya get the big pushes, whereas Gail and a couple of other divas would put on better matches. Well, first of all, do you even know the meaning of the word nepotism? Now, if you're talking about people getting their jobs vis-a-vis nepotism, that nepotism is the reason they got their jobs, first of all, that doesn't apply to Michelle McCool, because Michelle McCool only got involved with The Undertaker after she was already working for WWE. Now, you can argue that Natalya, second-generation superstar, one of the few second-generation divas in WWE, obviously, that helped her get her foot in the door. But Natalya's been here for a while, and they've done nothing with her. Finally, she's being given an opportunity to show how good she is in the ring. She just won the championship not too long ago. Is Jim the Anvil Neidhart working backstage for WWE, pushing and politicking for his daughter? Am I not aware of this? I don't see where nepotism applies in that particular case. And for the record, Gail Kim, who I was a big fan of when she first came over. I mean, Kim is her and Kong together were responsible for really making that TNA Knockouts division the success that it was all those years ago. And I don't think Gail Kim ever should have been let go in the first place from WWE. I mean, that was a head-scratcher to a lot of people, including a lot of wrestlers at the time that happened a couple of years ago. Fact remains, Gail Kim hasn't been very good since she came back to WWE. I don't know what happened, but it's almost like every time I see her in the ring, she's botching a move, botching another move. She doesn't look as solid and fluid in there as she has in the past. I know she's capable of great things. She's very attractive, and she could be their featured diva. But the fact is, since she came back, she has not been very good. So I don't know what you're talking about there, but I think you may need to go back and watch some of her more recent matches. Sky sent in an interesting message here. I'm sitting here reading about social thinking and behavior and psychological disorders for my psychology class. It's pretty fucking obvious that Vince McMahon is and has some serious, mental disorders. Antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, delusions of grandeur, etc. Big shock, right? Well, Vince McMahon, we've known for years, has some problems up in his cranium, let's just say. And we have had our fair share of segments over the years on Monday Night Raw and skits and whatnot where Vince McMahon will come out to the ring, grab the mic, and just rant on somebody or something. And you really can't help but sit there while you're listening to him and think, this is the sort of thing that he should be doing on a couch in a doctor's office. And we, unfortunately, are subjected to his diatribes. We haven't been for a while since he's been off TV, thank God. But, yes, I would agree. I think it's quite obvious to anybody with or without an education in psychology that Vince ain't all there. Or Vince is a little disturbed. You know, his upbringing, his childhood was not without its I guess, share of problems. I think he's actually alluded before to possibly being sexually molested as a child. So I'm sure there is some stuff going on up there in Vince's brain. Got a nice email here from a new listener. Matt Scala writes in, "Your Matt Hardy rant on Sound Off 126 has me geeking out right now. I couldn't agree more with the stuff that you say. I just found this website, that being SC Scoops, and I'm going back each day to listen to the Sound Off, each of the old episodes. Thanks for the entertainment." Here's a question, though, for your next Sound Off. Who's your top pick in terms of skills, mic ability, and overall ability to draw money for NXT Season 4? While I believe WWE would be better off without NXT, between the karaoke and the obstacle courses and all that crap, I'm still going to say Brodus Clay is the most intimidating person ever on NXT and hope to see him added to the roster shuffle. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. Brodus Clay, from what I've seen, I have not seen every episode of NXT, and there's only been maybe 3 episodes so far. From what I've seen of him, he's very well spoken, and he's a big dude, and he can go in that ring. You know, I got to say, when I first saw him, when they were showing those promo packages, when they first announced the roster for Season 4, and I saw a picture of him, I didn't think much of him, to be honest with you, but he's slowly winning me over. And, you know, Byron Saxton is another guy who, he's a main event player in every way, except perhaps in-ring ability, and that's not to say that he's bad in the ring, but on the microphone, he's a main event guy. Personality-wise, he's a main event guy. In the ring, he could be a main event guy. He's got a good look. You know, Byron Saxton and I think Brodus Clay are two of the guys that really stand out for me the most so far on NXT. And the season's still young. You know, there's still plenty of time yet to go. You know, there's people out there on the season who don't impress me so much, like Jacob Novak. But even Derek Bateman, who is Daniel Bryan's rookie, I can't think of a better pro to have than Daniel Bryan. And Derek Bateman inside the ring has looked very impressive to me as well. So, you know, again, it's a shame how many people are possibly watching this show? I mean, let's be honest here. But these guys are getting experience in front of the WWE audience. And, you know, they can only get used to it. You know, the more you perform out there with the real wrestlers and you have these mixed matches where you've got Daniel Bryan as your partner against Alberto Del Rio and his, you know, his rookie and stuff, it's just more and more experience that you're gaining. It's just weird after how much of a joke they treated Season 3 with the women and Michael Cole going out there every week and pretending to be sleeping and he's railing, calling the show crappy. Him and Josh Matthews are just completely treating it like a fucking joke. And now the men are back. All of a sudden it's Season 4 and we have to get serious again. Because, you know, we kind of want to make new stars to make sure we're still going to be around in 5 or 10 years. So it's kind of interesting to see how their attitude changed so much from Season 3 to Season 4. Let's see here, we have Dear Solomonster. Why would Samoa Joe sign with TNA after he has essentially been buried this entire year? I can understand that if there was no chance WWE would sign him, but if there was even a small chance to go to WWE, why would he even think about staying put in TNA? I don't know, to be honest with you. Nobody knows except Samoa Joe. He did re-sign with TNA. It's supposedly anywhere from a 2 to 3 year deal. Dixie Carter announced it on her Twitter, because that's how TNA makes their big announcements, on Dixie Carter's fucking Twitter. The bottom line is, from what I understand, WWE does not have any interest in Samoa Joe. I don't know if Joe is aware of that or not. The consensus from what I've read seems to be that there was simply no interest this time around from WWE. Whereas before, there had been interest at some point. But again, it just goes to show you how badly TNA has just beaten down and watered down Samoa Joe on TV to where he basically means nothing. And if WWE didn't have an interest in him, he doesn't have very many other options unless he wants to go back to Ring of Honor. And I think he and a lot of people would look at that as a step down. So TNA is going to be his home for another 2 or 3 years. And at that point, we'll see if they've been able to either rehabilitate him or if they've been able to completely destroy Samoa Joe altogether. Eddie from Ireland writes in, been a listener since episode 117. Triple H has wanted to be a heel for some time now. Do you think he could come back as one? I think it would be cool for him to come back at TLC, make it look like he was going to cost Sheamus the match against John Morrison, but actually help him. Going on to say how Sheamus reminds him of himself and does whatever he needs to do to get ahead. I don't see this happening, but it would be a nice twist. What do you think? I don't think that would be a very good twist at all. And again, if he helps Sheamus win the match, Sheamus and Miz for the title at Royal Rumble, nobody's going to buy that. And again, nobody's going to buy the fact it's just one of those stupid Vince Russo wrestling swerves that's being done for the sake of doing a swerve. The last time we saw Triple H, I mean, they showed the clip on Raw during the Slammies of Triple H about to cut this emotional promo on the night that Shawn Michaels was leaving the company, his farewell speech, and Sheamus attacked him from behind with a lead pipe. And he never did get to say those words, at least publicly, to Shawn Michaels. And then, of course, they had their match at Extreme Rules or whatever that pay-per-view was, where Sheamus finally beat Triple H, beat him down real bad to the point that Triple H in storyline has been out for basically the entire rest of 2010 as a result of injuries sustained at the hands of Sheamus. So what sense would it make for Triple H to come back and befriend Sheamus? I mean, again, it's stuff like that that makes it look so fake and so phony. You can do swerves and have shocking twists and turns in wrestling, but only if they make sense. And that would not make a lot of sense. Now, Triple H, does he work better as a face or as a heel? Triple H is over pretty well as a babyface, but I think he does work better as a heel. He does want to be heel, but it's not his call, ultimately. It's what Vince McMahon, you know, thinks is best for business. And right now, there seems to be a babyface shortage, especially now with, you know, Shawn Michaels gone. And, you know, I don't know that they're going to want him to be a heel right now. Eventually, I'm almost positive that Triple H, perhaps even sometime in 2011, will be a heel again. But for him to first come back and befriend Sheamus instead of beating him up would not make a lot of sense. And lastly here, we got a message from Shadfather. That's what he calls himself. So, Dear Solid Monster, I want to give you a double thumbs up for promoting the TV series The Shield on a recent podcast. I heard that you mentioned it, downloaded the season one, and after watching the pilot episode, I was hooked and will continue to watch it until the end. And to any other listeners who have not checked this out, I implore you, please watch the show. I wish someone had told me sooner. Well, I am happy if I have converted even just one person to watching The Shield, then I have done my job. It is just one of the best pieces of TV drama that you'll ever find. It's my all-time favorite TV series, and it had a nice run. 7 seasons. Season 1, I think I said it the last time I mentioned it on the show, and I'll say it again. If you're going to watch The Shield, you got to watch it from the very first episode from the very first season. Because if you watch that first episode and you're not hooked, or at least even somewhat curious to watch the next couple of episodes based on what happens in that first one, you may not like the show. But I can guarantee that most normal people listening to this show will watch that, unless you're just not into cop shows or vulgarity or anything like that. But if you watch that show from the very first episode, you will be hooked. It is the only way that you can do it, is to watch it from the very first episode. And you, like Shadfather, will be giving me the double thumbs up. So, yes, I heartily endorse his endorsement, and thumbs up for The Shield. But anyway, his actual question here. He was watching old videos of Monday Night Raw back in 1995. The Ringmaster, Stone Cold, Steve Austin, made his debut at that time. Would have been early 95. I was surprised when I saw who his opponent was. Do any of you know who it was against? Anyway, great podcast. Been a listener since episode 80. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Shadfather, for that email. And yes, indeed, I do know it was Matt Hardy who was, I believe, Steve Austin's opponent as the Ringmaster. I was going to say Scott Taylor, and I know he did have a match against Scott Taylor, who, of course, would later go on to become Scotty Too Hotty, but I believe it was Matt Hardy who Steve Austin beat up in his very first match in the WWF. And quite frankly, yeah, you can probably find the video on YouTube. It's always a pleasure to watch somebody beat the shit out of Matt Hardy. So, there you go. So, that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. All emails should be directed to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. That is separate from the main SC Scoops mailbag, which I post up once a week on the website. Those are for questions that are to be answered in that particular forum and not on this show. You can send those inquiries to sescoops@gmail.com. But anything to me or this show, don't send it to that address. Send it to thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can reach out to me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolomonster. You can get there. Get on Facebook. I keep saying that one of these days we're going to do another Facebook or Twitter-only mailbag, and I promise you we will. I just haven't decided when. When that time comes, unless you are a friend on Facebook or a follower on Twitter, you will be left out, so find me on there. One last note here I wanted to say. There were one or two people last week who said that they had downloaded the show off of iTunes and that it was cutting off at the very end. I was talking about Eric Bischoff during the mailbag towards the very end of the podcast, and it just stops. And I checked. Everything seemed to be okay. The entire show uploaded for everybody else to download, and I didn't get this complaint from anybody else. And I certainly did not get this complaint from anybody who downloaded the show using the right-click file save as on the SC Scoops page. As it turned out, I think one of these people did say that the show just didn't fully load for them, and that's probably why it got cut off. But just as an FYI, if this is a problem at any point for anyone in the future, just check, because it's possible the podcast, for whatever reason, didn't fully load for you. But if there is something happening where it's getting cut off and you got it through iTunes, you could just go to the website. Just go to the website, open up the post, and just download it that way, and it's guaranteed to be fine. I check these things out every time I upload them to make sure they're uploaded successfully, and they are. You can always rely on that fact. But don't let that stop you from subscribing via iTunes, because generally speaking, it does make one's life a lot easier if you subscribe, and the show will automatically download for you each time a new sound off goes up. Speaking of which, there will be a new one, episode 139, coming up next weekend. That is actually Christmas weekend. There will be a sound off. Don't know when. It'll be sometime that Saturday or Sunday. And for those of you who are celebrating Christmas, who are celebrating the holidays, I want to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I will. There'll be another show before New Year's, but I may as well just wish everybody Merry Christmas and Happy New Year now while I have the chance. So, yeah, eat, drink, and be merry next weekend. There'll be another episode of The Sound Off then. We'll talk about TLC and everything else that happens between now and then. Hopefully all good, nothing bad. So until next time, be well, stay safe, and have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SCScoops.com.